The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com. FlyPod.com, I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have the author of, let's see, it's kind of a disturbing book. The book's Truthers. It's by Jeffrey Gerard. Jeffrey, welcome.
Good afternoon. Hello.
I mean, disturbing in a good way, I guess.
No, it's disturbing's okay. I mean, I get it. For most people, the topic of Truthers. And should I do the pitch book, the pitch for the book, so everyone knows why you find it so disturbing? Here's what's disturbing about it, and the main character finds it disturbing as well. The main character is a teenage girl who is told by her father one afternoon that you are not actually my daughter. That's disturbing to start. And more to it than that, not only are you not my daughter, but the way I got you was on 9/11, when the government or agencies within the United States were organizing the 9/11 attacks, and we're making it happen so we could go to war in the Middle East, you were sort of spirited away like Moses in the bulrushes. And all these passengers that were secretly whisked away and killed by these American people, you were saved that day, and I've been raising you ever since, and you are proof of this big, huge conspiracy. And that is disturbing. That is, I mean, there are a lot of things just from a personal level, but that's a fictional thing. But obviously, the historic idea that our government or agencies or groups within the United States actually had something to do with the planning of or carrying out of 9/11 or even looking the other way to allow it to happen is disturbing. And it is not what most people believe, and it is not what most all historians and studies suggest, but it is something that as many as 35% of Americans believe. That's a big number. I mean, 35% is a big number. And I also know 35% of Americans probably can't find Afghanistan on a map. And that's not a slam, but I mean, I guess it is a slam. But, and I'm not saying it's the same group necessarily either, because the vast majority of quote unquote truthers, the people who suspect that there might have been something a lot more going on that day, could find Afghanistan on a map. It's a different group. It's predominantly a very educated group. They're usually professionals. They're usually on the tech end professionals, like scientists and engineers and things like that, computer folks. And so it's actually an educated group who believes this, but that's a big number. And if that is disturbing, then so be it. But I use that as the sort of boiling pot to discuss other things.
You know, Jeffrey, that's why I picked up the book. That's why I wanted you in here. It's such a great story that the government could have, and of course, you know, the conspiracy story is out there, and you pretty much put that into a story, which I really wanted to read.
Well, thanks. Cool. I mean, that was the idea. My target audience, it's written for teens and young adults. But I'm glad that obviously if it reaches out to an adult that way too, that, I mean, that's perfect. I'm a high school teacher that's my normal regular job. Not that being a writer is not, you know what, that's my regular job. And so my students, when they talk about conspiracy stuff, I thought it is a sort of launch pad for, as you said, that sounds kind of fun and interesting. And that's good. As a teacher, that's gold. As soon as someone says, ooh, that kind of sounds fun, interesting, now I've got the path to other discussions on the real history of that day and why there are conspiracy theories and where do we get our news and how do you avoid fake news and alternative facts and all this kind of stuff. How do you work around that in a world in which that gets more and more difficult? And then the sort of thematic stuff, self-discovery, that comes along with fictional characters as they go on this sort of emotional roller coaster of trying to figure out truth in a world where that's not so easy sometimes.
You know, Jeffrey, I'm sure you talk to a lot of other teachers in the school system itself. How does it differ maybe with your class? Here you are an author. You have something solid here that the kids can read, and I'm sure that a lot of the kids have read this. How do they maybe look at you as opposed to maybe some of the other teachers?
Well, that's
a different question.
Yeah, no, I got to think about that one. I'm also the department chair, and I'm going to speak up for my boys. Like, we got a good group of, like, I'm just doing for the English teachers. It's a good group, man. So I don't know if being the published author who has a couple books under his belt, it's a well-read, well-rounded group. We are all there to teach our guys critical thinking. I say guys because we're at an all-boys school. We're there to teach the students critical thinking. I think we're all on the same page as far as our goals. Our methods are slightly different, but not all that much. Yeah, we're just so much into getting our guys to think outside of the box and to have the guts to look at disturbing stuff and stuff that they necessarily don't agree with, that I don't know if there is much of a difference. I don't know if I'm bringing like some kind of new way of looking at things.
Yeah, and I might think as a student, wow, you know, here's Jeffrey, you know, Mr. Gerard, a teacher, and that's what I want to be as a teacher. But if you're thinking outside the box, you're going like, wow, I could be a teacher and something
into
else
this,
like
into
an
that.
Author. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I'm more and more starting to talk about my life as an author, and you feel kind of embarrassed about it at first. I mean, for years, I just like, it's just kind of goofy to talk about it. It sounds like you're, whatever, patting yourself on the back or whatever. But it is part of who I am, and I do meet interesting people and get to exposed to things. Like I was just in Japan this summer on a research trip for the next book I'm writing. And so to not talk about that with my students would be silly. So I am getting better about doing stuff like that. I don't know. I think all teachers, you know this, we're always looking at our teachers, whatever they are. It could be biology teachers, whatever they do on the side. I don't care if they collect bees or they're the football coach or they sail around the world. We had one of our teachers recently that did sailed around the world, took a year off to sail around the world. That's the last time I say it. That's just as interesting. I don't know. I'm kind of deflecting this thing, but I think there are a lot of interesting teachers out there and so, yeah, I guess.
and kudos, because, I mean, if it wasn't for the teachers, the kids wouldn't have the opportunities probably that they have.
Well, sure. You know, one thing I will – here's another shout out to teachers is I found interesting in doing research for how teens get their information nowadays, how they sort of determine fact from fiction. The number one source to figuring it out is parents. So parents, nice job. Just regardless of what you think your teenagers are thinking about what you're saying, you are number one with a bullet kind of thing. It's like 65-70% of teens absolutely trust parents as far as if you say, hey, this is what's really going on with X, Y, or Z, they believe you. And number two on the list is is teachers. And it was also in the high 60s. And friends was like in the 20s or 30s. Friends was third, but there's a huge drop as far as trusting your buddy on what's right or wrong as far as the news. But amazing. I was actually surprised. I mean, maybe I shouldn't be, but it was nice to see, let's say, teachers that high up. They are looking at us and listening and sort of trusting us for guidance sometimes on what to believe and what not.
All right. Now, you know, you mentioned Moses and you have this little girl. Her mother's boarding an airplane. She asks this man more or less to save her daughter, if you will. You mentioned Moses and, of course, he was saved by floating him down in a reed basket.
Right.
Did you kind of look at that and put that something like that into Truthers? Is that maybe how you come up with an idea like that? Or
I don't know. I just think it's the metaphor I use, the quickest way to sort of explain what happened. That one version of the conspiracy theory is that the passenger – and trigger warning here – but so because it's pretty dark stuff. But one of the versions of what happened that day is that the passengers, the real passengers on the planes, were taken off the planes and disposed of. And either they're living life fantastically on some island under assumed names, or they're disposed of. And that fake planes, quote unquote, drones or whatever, were driven into the buildings and stuff like that. Like I said, that's pretty dark, gruesome stuff. So the idea of a survivor of that. I always had this image of, because the other character is Katie, is the girl that sort of survives. This is 15 years later after 9/11, and she's now 17 years old, and she was this little 2-year-old handed over, and it's her father who's saying that this happened. So it's sort of from his point of view that this woman handed him this child to save it. And I was also interested in, you know, what would you do if you were ordered to do X, Y, or Z? And part of what this book is exploring is how far gone dad is. Like, is this completely made up? Is dad nuts? Is there any truth to what he's saying? Are there other issues, hint, 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 going on in his life that somehow have something to do with the way he remembers things?
In Truthers, I had a hard time figuring out who was maybe a good person, who was a bad person. What was the challenge with making that web?
I want to put that on a blurb, as a blurb on the back of the book. I like that. Cause that's, thank you. I'm going to take that as a huge compliment. It is difficult to tell who good guys and bad guys are. I think it's probably always been so. You can watch Game of Thrones, even in fantasy land. It's tough to tell who the good guys and the bad guys are. And fiction sort of allows you to play with that almost in a safe way. But where that's tough, there's one of the characters who, as you said, I don't want to give too much away. It's like a spoiler thing. Is sort of like a bad guy and is spying and is kind of, most people would put this person in a bad guy category, but he has a conversation at one point with sort of himself, the reader, and what he says, boy, if people only knew why I was doing, like, I'm doing this for the best of reasons. So you have people who are doing good reasoned things, but doing it in a bad way, and you have people that are doing good things, but for bad reasons, and et cetera, et cetera. So how did I balance that? You know what? I try to make real characters. I try to make characters that were realistic, and realistic, we don't wear black hats and white hats. We all sort of wear gray hats, and sometimes they're a little more white or black, depending on what we're doing, but there are a lot of gray hats out there. And I think that's part of the confusion for all of us as we walk around the world, especially, I think, if you're a teenager.
With Truthers, I know you have another book coming out. We'll talk about that, Mary Rose. But in Truthers, and maybe even this book and past books, do you have a journal where you keep track of the people and maybe put down what they're like and what they do so you kind of don't mess up? I mean, if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. Now, there are a lot of authors who do that, have books filled with, and they have conversations with their characters, and their characters write letters and have whole lives that are outside the book. No, not necessarily for me. I think I had a pretty small stage on Truthers. I've had bigger characters and more stuff running around. The Kane books, I had tons of people running around. This one, I could focus on Katie, the teen girl, and Max, her buddy, who she picks up along the way. They were sort of the main folks that I could. I had them pretty well locked in my head. I don't think about characters. I think what helps is I don't think about characters until like the very end of the process. I did 6 months easy, and that's probably low estimate of research for Truthers, reading the 9/11 stuff, both what really happened, the official story of what really happened, and then the sort of fringe versions of what happened. 20, 25 books, 50 plus websites, all sorts of stuff, articles, blah, 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 blah. So I did it 6 months of research before I even knew who Katie was. So once I had all this information in my head, then I started, the way I do it, and this is why I think I do most of my books now that I think of it. Now that I have all that info in my head, I start thinking, okay, who would be an interesting character to sort of struggle within this world a little bit. I've got the world figured out. I know the kinds of things I want to talk about, and I've got all the facts and what might happen. All right, who can I mess with in this world? Who would be, oh, a teenager, oh, she'd be a girl, and she, oh, and her dad was actually, oh, and she has to, oh, and she meets this guy, and he's this, and then I start building the characters that way. And I think maybe because I had the characters last, I don't have to do all that, because the world is so ready for like a real person to sort of walk around and do stuff in, that they're pretty well formed in my head by the time I write a single sentence.
Jeffrey, you mentioned that you read a lot of books about the conspiracy, about what happened and the conspiracy. Do the conspirators make a good case for what happened? Because when you were reading that, were you like, yeah, I can see that.
Yes, that, the rabbit hole, as it's called. You go down there in a hurry. Part of what makes conspiracy work so well is that, especially now, we have so much information. We have access to so much information. So you take something like the Kennedy assassination, the Zapruder film or whatever. That's one clip of film that everyone uses, and you can go you can look at it from certain angles, and you can say this, that, or the other thing. There's only so much you can say about that one film. And even then, you know, some of the best-selling, even with that, 75-80% of the country believes there was a conspiracy involved with the Kennedy assassination. And top-selling books for 30 years focus on that aspect of the Kennedy presidency. And that's from one piece of film. You take something like 9/11, where there are thousands of shots and pictures and films, and you run the risk, here's the danger, you get to sort of pick and choose what you show. You show the stuff that best supports, you know, if I want to prove that Hester Prynne is X, Y, or Z, sorry, I'm going to Scarlet Letter, then I will just show the quotes that support that. And part of these books that you're talking about and part of what makes conspiracy so powerful. And today I can find clips that I've been using the example of Queen Elizabeth as a vampire. I can find enough clips on the internet to prove that right now. I could put something up tonight. I'm not going to, Queen. But I could put a little PowerPoint together or a video. No, PowerPoint, please. I'm going to do a nice little video with cool music and stuff. I'm going to get some pictures where the Queen of England has some jelly on her chin or whatever. She's just looking a little pale or whatever. One little snaggle tooth is sticking out. And I'll just find enough pictures, and I'll only use those, and I'll put those out, and I'll make a successful argument that perhaps the Queen of England is a vampire. And maybe I'll get a couple of people to run with it, and who knows. As far as reading those books, yes, they do make powerful arguments. There is sketchy stuff that went on that day. The government didn't do such a great job of telling us everything. I'm not going to go too far down that path now, but there was involvement of some major allies of ours that day that is a little embarrassing. So we're going to go hush hush on that. That's fine. And there were things that happened. We got caught with our pants down, basically, and all of our agencies were embarrassed by what happened. So it got swept under the carpet very quickly so we could move on and respond to what was done to us. I get that. But in the process, yes, a lot of information is a little skeptical and questionable and needs to be pointed at. Yeah, conspiracy allows you to focus on just specific things. That sort of idea of selective exposure where you're deciding what to look at and what to read and what to see. And conspiracy guys, I can show you, anything I want.
Yeah, and I guess it's almost like, oh, this product is bad for you, and we had it tested, and this many people said that it was bad. It depends on who's paying for it as to why it's good or bad.
Which is one of the things media literacy we're always teaching our students, try to figure out who paid for this, who might be behind this thing. And even if no one's paying for it, I've been given the example lately. As far as doing research, one of my earlier books was about Native Americans, and I needed to know the date of when the Vikings first showed up in North America. And I got a hold of a brand new article on a 25-page peer-reviewed, high-level, written by a PhD article by when the Vikings showed up. And it was hard to read. And so I got the date. Now I'm talking to another PhD, the second biggest expert in the country on Vikings coming to America, if there is such a thing. And I kind of dropped that, hey, I read this article. I want to let the guy know I wasn't a joke, that I'd done my research and I was really taking this stuff seriously. And as soon as I told him about the article and the date, he's like, oh, that guy's an idiot. He's off by 150 years. Here's why. And then he starts giving me other information and a completely different date. So here I am sitting in my little house. I have two guys who've devoted their lives to knowing when Vikings showed up in North America. And they're arguing with each other. Show me two experts. I will show you three opinions and good luck. So to your point, even when you get to the bottom of like, well, who's this information coming from? And even if they don't have an agenda, sometimes it's very tough to figure out what the truth is. I mean, I have a window of 150 years there. So what you end up doing is what most people end up doing statistically is you choose the one that best suits your needs, that best suits the things that you already believed. If you think the government's a bunch of creeps who do all sorts of horrible things, you're probably part of that 30-35%. If you're like, no way, that would never happen, that's disgusting, then there's nothing that could be said the other way. And that's just the way we're kind of built. We gravitate towards the news that makes us comfortable. And today we live in an age in which we get to choose our news. We get to handpick. I want this article and this article. I want to hear this from this person. I want these words blocked. And on Twitter, I never want to see X, Y, and Z. And when I'm on Facebook, this person's blocked and this person's silenced. And I don't want anything from this horrible magazine. How dare they? And so the echo chamber gets smaller and smaller and smaller every day, which is pretty dangerous.
But talking about a new book, he's got Mary Rose coming out also. This pretty much a ghost story, huh?
Yes, something different flavor, yes.
Yeah, give me a little bit of a sense of Mary Rose.
Mary Rose. Mary Rose originally was a play written by J.M. Barrie, who's the guy who wrote Peter Pan. It was a play in 1920s when it came out, and it was a play about a girl who vanishes. She vanishes for 30 days, she comes back, no one really knows where she was for 30 days, and she comes back different. And it sort of follows her through her adult years and there's some disappearances and there's some strangeness and there is a ghost involved, and it is written by the guy who wrote Peter Pan. So there's some very creepy, dark moments, but there's also some playful, sort of fantastical moments. Alfred Hitchcock, of all people, he saw this play as a child His mom took him to the play, and he was blown away by it. There was something about the play that just sort of struck him. This idea of this girl vanishing and this woman vanishing, and you know what really came home and what was going on for those 30 days, you know, that kind of stuff. So Hitchcock, for decades, wanted to make a movie version of Mary Rose. And he used to joke that the studios would let him make any movie as long as it cost less than $1 million and as long as it wasn't Mary Rose. But he just kept trying, and he'd hire different writers, and he kept, you know, this is the one I want to make next. Why don't you try this? Why don't you try that? Here we go 50 years later, and it ends up on my doorstep. A movie studio named Adaptive Studios got a hold of the property, and they think there's definitely something there. And so one of the things that they asked to have happen is for, their publishing arm, they wanted a modern version of this Mary Rose written as a novel for folks. So they'd read my Cain's Blood novel and really liked it. So they contacted me and said, hey, could you, you know, look at this old play from 1920 and sort of do your Cain's Blood thing to it, make it more modern, make it a sort of psychological thriller in the vein of Hitchcock, and see what you can do. So Mary Rose, which comes out in the middle of October, is what I did.
So, you know, they want it in the vein of Alfred Hitchcock. Did you have to read a lot of Hitchcock? Did you have to watch a lot of movies? How did that come about?
It was funny. I was so excited. I found the script that Hitchcock had paid for Mary Rose. He got a couple people to write scripts. I found one online. And I called up my, the editors, and I said, hey guys, I found this script. And they're like, don't read it. You know, you don't look at it. And I hadn't yet. And I really hadn't. They're like, oh, no, legally, you can't look at that because that's not covered. The play is old enough that we can do stuff with the play. But the script, I'm like, so I wasn't allowed to actually look at the Alfred Hitchcock script. For now that the book's out, I guess I should go back and actually see what they might have done. Because I just tucked it away. And that file went away. I'm like, fine, I'll never look at it. I know Hitchcock's films. I've watched, I guess, pretty much all of them several times. So I know Hitchcock is a film viewer, and there's certainly some Hitchcockian themes and ideas, stuff he does with the male gaze and things he does specifically with the way he tells thrillers and the way he reveals information that I definitely wanted to use in the book. I use all of that. So there's definitely Hitchcockian themes are in the book.
You know, with writing a novel, Mary Rose, of a play going back to the 20s, maybe you know this, maybe you don't, but what would the laws be if there were something else out there? I mean, you can take that if it's not copyrighted anymore and create something else?
Mary Rose is in the public domain. The play is old enough that they felt comfortable doing that. So that's why I wasn't allowed to look at the Hitchcock script. That's not in the public domain, but the play was. And even that's a technicality. I was only allowed to look at a review of the play because the play originally appeared in England, and that's what bought enough time. If I were to use the American play and the American publication of the play, that's not in public domain, and that I couldn't look at. So it's funny. There are all these things I wasn't allowed to look at. I took it as a sort of, theme again. It's sort of like I was doing my own little mystery, trying to find Mary Rose as I'm discovering this missing girl, because like I kept getting hints of like, here's where she might be, where the story might be, but I wasn't actually allowed to look at it. So technically all I had to work from was a very long detailed review of the play. Fortunately, it was detailed enough that I could tell what was going on. But yeah, believe me, there are gorgeous lines in the play that I wanted to steal outright, because I'm like, oh, you know, it's Jan Barry, a guy knows how to write. It's such a great line. I want to use that. And I wasn't allowed to. So, but so be it.
So you're headed off to Hollywood to find out about this. Do you see yourself maybe involved in the script writing?
That's an interesting story. Probably, you know what? I took a stab at it, since you ask. I took a stab at the script writing.
Script writing's a lot different than writing
novels.
It
was very different, and it was a learning experience, you know, for your first one, and to turn it in to an actual movie studio. I think they were very kind to me. You know, like the first I turned it in, it was like, I didn't turn it in. It was like 240 pages. And if any of you are script writers, you're laughing your heads off right now, because even my son, who's studying some stuff up in school right now, he's like, are you nuts? A horror script is supposed to be 90 pages. So I was at 240 because I took my novel and I turned it into a script, and 240 pages. So the movie would be like patent length. It'd be a 4.5 hour movie. There'd be an intermission. Then I went in, and as a writer, and it is an interesting process as a writer to go into your own work and figure out like what don't I need? This has to be bare bones. How do I get this story down to 90 minutes? And who you thought, like, oh, this character's the best, gone, off the page. And this is why books are often better than movies, usually better than movies. But, like, complete characters would go, and scenes would go, and characters would double up, and now this scene's moving here, and this scene, I really like, that scene's gone. And so that was all an interesting process. I think the idea of the way Hollywood works, you know, they have the script, it's in their back pocket if they need it. They're polite enough to say, yeah, it's pretty good. You know, if it were my seventh script, maybe they would have bought it and sat on and done something with it. They have it. I think the best hope for this on its Hollywood trail is to find a right producer or director/writer. Very often now, especially in horror films, if you find a director with writer skills, I mean, having both and finding someone who just loves the story and can do his or her own thing with it, that would be superb. That's fine. I trust that process.
Well, you know, let's get back to Truthers, your book that's been out here for a while. Mary Rose coming out, hopefully, to a big screen someday. But Truthers, I mean, I'm sure kids in your school have read this. What kind of feedback do you get from them? And I'm going to make kind of a two-part question. I know you hate probably me doing this.
No, it's...
But when you're in class, do you ever come up with ideas from maybe things that students have said?
A lot of these ideas come from that. Of course, the Kane books. There's a book called Project Kane, Kane's Blood. Those are my first two big Simon & Schuster traditional publisher books. Those came directly out from conversations with students. We were talking about serial killers one day, and they were super interested but didn't know all that much. So for me, that was a book idea. And Truthers is the exact same thing. We were talking about conspiracy theories one day, and they were super interested but didn't know that much about 9/11. My freshmen weren't alive. My seniors were one, maybe 2 years old. Yeah, I know it's just absurd, but that's where we are. 15 years has passed. And I said, you know, there's an opportunity for a book. They have all these questions about the conspiracy, but they don't really know much about the history or why conspiracy theories are important, why they should be studied and talked about. So here's an opportunity. So that's, I definitely get ideas from the classroom there. And the first part was, you asked me, I know, I'm sorry.
Yeah. What do the kids think about Truthers?
Oh,
what kind of feedback do you get?
The book kind of just came out, so let's face it. Right now, hopefully, they should be reading Hemingway and who else are they reading right now? Hemingway and Truman Capote is who they should be reading right now. But as far as my stuff, reviews that are online from, and I'm going to take it. These are from teenagers, librarians. I love you, librarians. Teenagers, librarians, and Publishers Weekly and Starred Review. All three, what I really love, the one thing that they all keep going to is how balanced the book is. So I really want to stress that, because readers are getting at. There have been a couple people that come to it with a lot of baggage on one end or the other and are just like, oh, absolutely not. The vast majority sort of get and understand how balanced this book is and how there's characters representing half a dozen different viewpoints in this book. And they're represented fairly and respectfully, I think, and they give their information, and I trust the reader to sort of do his or her own thing with that information and come up with their own questions, conclusions. You know, maybe they can get mad at one character, be like, oh, this is good, you're supposed to. This is a bunch of different people with different viewpoints, and I want to get that out of the reader, and that's why I have the characters in here that I did. So right now, that's the feedback. Maybe that's the feedback I'm looking for. I don't think it was at first, actually, necessarily, but when the first big review came out from Publishers Weekly and they specifically called out how balanced it was, I'm like, you know what? It is a balanced book. And I sort of pushed that off to the side and like how hard I worked on that. And you kind of take things for granted. You work so hard on them, you almost forget that you were doing it. So both my editor and I, the editors at Carol Rhoda Lab, it was very important to both she and I that it was a balanced book and that people were presented fairly and respectfully. So.
All right, you know, talking about online and people talking online, where could we maybe find you at? Do you have a website where maybe we could look at Truthers, the Kane series, new books coming up?
You're very boring. Well, not very boring. The obvious, Jeffrey Gerard, and it's Jeffrey with a G, like Chaucer or the giraffe, and Gerard is G-I-R-A-R-D. It's jeffreygerard.com. And Jeffrey Gerard, you also find me on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all that horrible stuff that you're supposed to be on nowadays. You'll find me there as well.
You know, social media, I don't know if social media was big when your first books came out. I don't imagine it was.
It's been 5 years. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, it was big then. It was a thing then.
Okay, so you really don't. you really don't know what it was like then before and how things have changed today. Or maybe you do. Maybe it's getting better.
I think so. As far as what?
As far as more people.
Marketing books? It's writers sit around tables and we argue about this all the time. No one knows. The publishers, no one knows. Give me $1 million and I can make you a bestseller. I can get you, if I lay out 20,000 copies of Girl on a Train and I spread them all over New York, I can get you a bestseller. And it's a good book, but there are a lot of good books out there. So it's just social media. There are people who argue both ways. You know, you want to sell a lot of books, you put it on sale for 99 cents on Kindle. You'll sell a lot of books. That's another way to sell a lot of books. Word of mouth, trickle sometimes works. And so, you know, all the writers, we sort of, you get to the point where you kind of have to pick and choose what you're good at, what you like, what works for you. I think we're all kind of still trying to guess. As I said, the publishers are still trying to guess. There's so many different with the self-pub and the little regional markets and the smaller publishers and the micro publishers and the niche things. And it's crowded market out there. So I know for myself personally, and like I said, my writer friends, we talk the same way. You sort of pick the ones that work for you. What works for me, I love classroom visits. I love getting out in front. I'm a teacher. I like to be in front of people if I can get the energy from a group of people and just talking. That's it. I'm terrible at social media. I'm turning 50 in a couple months here. I'm not exactly the social media demographic. So it doesn't work for me. It takes me about 4 seconds to say something online that's going to bother someone. I'll lose more readers than I'll gain. So it's not really worth it for me. I'm just not good at it. It's not something I'd be interested in. If I weren't a writer, I don't think I'd ever be on it. So I do just enough, keep publishers happy and let people know I'm alive and I have some stuff up there. But for the most part, I like to do the book events, things like that. Get me in front of real people. And I think there I make some sense and I might be able to actually, you know, sell a couple books and meet cool people.
All right. Well, you know, the book is Truthers by Jeffrey Gerard. You know, what if things weren't really the way that you thought they were? With this book, it'll make you think a little bit. With Katie, do you feel sorry for her? Do you want her maybe to do something different? Well, check out Truthers, and it'll keep you on the edge of your seat. Jeffrey, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me in again. Appreciate it, man.
I'm Mark DeWitt for Cover to Cover.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.